Hello, hello. It's Jacob Hill with GRC Academy. Today I'm here with Ms. Hamza Mahindranathan. Hamza, how are you today?
I am so great, Jacob. Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you so much for coming on. And folks, if you're enjoying the podcast, take a moment to like, comment, share, subscribe, review, all the things. Helps me out. Thanks so much in advance. Hamza, tell me about yourself. How'd you get to where you are today?
I'm a lawyer. I live in New Jersey and I work in New York. I'm a partner at a law firm called Whistleblower Partners. We're a brand new law firm. We have offices in San Francisco, DC, and obviously New York, where I'm based. But I'm originally from the Midwest and no one in my family was a lawyer. I didn't mean to become a lawyer. And frankly, I didn't know what I wanted to be. So I went to law school because I thought if you go to law school, then you're just like on the path to being a lawyer. Came out of law school, I went straight to my first job as a lawyer in a big firm. Then after a few years, when I was looking to leave, I found this really great law firm called Constantine Cannon. The very first cases I started working on were false claims act cases. Like I felt like I fit in with that culture. I loved working on those cases. I was working with attorneys that I was learning so much from. And it was like the first time where I was like, oh, I guess I could work in a law firm. Like maybe I do fit in here. I worked at Constantine Cannon for 9 years. And just a few months ago, a group of my colleagues and I, we spun off our own firm called Whistleblower Partners. We are a group of 9 partners, an associate. We have a wonderful practice manager and paralegal and legal assistant. And we represent whistleblowers bringing false claims act cases and award submissions under the various agency award programs at the SEC, CFTC, FinCEN, IRS, and others. I really love representing whistleblowers. These cases are not the easiest and nobody really wants to be a whistleblower, I think. It's a privilege that I get to work with people who are struggling to be heard. And I want to be that person who listens to them and helps them figure out what's the right next step for them. That might be making a false claims act case or making a submission, or maybe not. That's not the right move for everybody. Whatever it is, like if you need to get connected to employment counsel, I want to help you do that. That's how I ended up doing what I do.
Thank you so much for sharing that story. I had that conversation with Ms. Julie Bracker on the federal False Claims Act side. I know that you have some interesting things to talk about when it comes to state and local False Claims Act. So tell us about that and what that is and maybe even how it's different.
Before I get started, I just want to say everything I'm sharing is just for informational purposes. None of this is legal advice. Please do not take this as legal advice. If you need legal advice, talk to an attorney. I am not your attorney. I am just sharing stories based on my life experience. I'm sure by now everybody has listened to that awesome podcast episode. I loved it. And Julie Bracker is like just an incredible source to learn about the federal False Claims Act run. But if you didn't get a chance, I'm just going to really quickly summarize. It's basically a statute that says anyone who submits or causes the submission of a false claim to the government is liable for 3 times the government's damages plus penalties for each of the false claims that were made. And it's basically a way for the government to recover for fraud and to disincentivize folks from defrauding the government. One of the very cool things about this act is that it allows private citizens to bring cases on behalf of the government, and those lawsuits are called QUITAMs, which is the proper pronunciation. That is not how I pronounce it, to my great shame. I cannot not say QUITAM. And the people who bring those QUITAMs are called relators. And those relators can get an award, which is typically between 15 and 30% of what the government has recovered based on how the case ends up going. There's this federal False Claims Act, but that's not the only False Claims Act. Dozens of states and even some counties and cities have their own versions of False Claims Act. A very few don't have a QUITAM, but then they have this reward program instead. So there's a lot of diversity in how each state has set up its system, but they typically follow sort of the same model as the federal. Some state false claims acts only focus on healthcare fraud. So you can't bring a cybersecurity case in that state unless it is involved with healthcare fraud in some way based on the state's damages, right? You could do it based on federal damages, obviously. If that wasn't confusing enough, cities will have it. Like Chicago has it. There's counties that have them. I think Allegheny County in Pennsylvania has a false claims act. As you can imagine, if you have a case where somebody is making false claims to many states and municipalities and the federal government, all of a sudden you have like a lot of different entities involved that need to coordinate to investigate the case and take enforcement action if they decide to do so. There's so many different moving parts here. Cases that involved a lot of different state false claims, that cases can get pretty messy. But one thing they have in common is that like the federal False Claims Act, a whistleblower will file their complaint under seal, which gives the government, state, local, whatever, a chance to investigate the allegations in the complaint. And so that case is secret when it's filed. Nobody knows about it except for the government. And maybe at some point, the government might tell the defendant because they want to start getting information from them to investigate. The federal False Claims Act, state or local government can decide at the end of that investigation, like, hey, we want to intervene, which means we want to take over and we want to prosecute this case and we're going to litigate it and take it to trial or to settlement. Or they could decide, we don't want to intervene, but you relator, you can take this case. They can decline to intervene. The whistleblower can prosecute the case. And so we've done that many times. Then, you know, you're litigating on behalf of the government and their damages. And then in very, very rare instances, the government can dismiss your case and say, you know, we don't want this case to move forward at all. Generally, that's how these cases go. And actually, one of the very earliest cases I worked on involved both state and federal False Claims Act claims, and it also involved cybersecurity violations.
Well, that sounds like it got really complicated for sure. Tell us about that. What went on and who was involved?
Before I get into the story, I just want to make really clear that, one, this was a really long time ago that these vulnerabilities were identified, and they're just alleged vulnerabilities, right? No court ever found that these vulnerabilities existed and the consequences of the vulnerabilities were as dire as we alleged. This was based on our client's perspective and the allegations that we made in our complaint. Cisco settled those allegations without admitting any liability. I think that's important to keep in mind because this is a story of James's experience and our experience as his attorneys, but I'm sure Cisco, you know, sees what happened very, very differently. And also, like, frankly, this was a really long time ago. I think in 2021, Julie had mentioned the government created this Civil Cyber Frauds Initiative. This was a long time before that. And I think this case can kind of get forgotten because it happened so long and it was resolved so long before that initiative was created. This case was filed in 2011 on behalf of our client, James Glenn. He is a network security specialist. And at the time, he was living in Copenhagen, Denmark. And we alleged that Cisco had really serious cybersecurity vulnerabilities in their video surveillance manager software. And we brought that case, we filed it in federal court, and it alleged claims under the Federal False Claims Act, but also the False Claims Acts of 18 states and Washington, D.C. Wow. You know, as we've discussed, like coordinating with all of those different government entities could have been really, really messy. But thankfully, we had an incredible client, an expert in this space, and he really helped the government understand why these vulnerabilities that we alleged were serious. And on top of that, we had a really great government attorney who really cared about this case and was like, you know, we got to get a good resolution of this complaint.
Tell us about James and how he decided to go ahead and do this. It must have been a big problem, right? Because as you alluded to earlier, it's a big decision.
That's a really great question. And frankly, I don't think James ever decided to do this. I don't think he decided to be a whistleblower. It sort of happened because he was really concerned about what he had been seeing. At the time, James was working at NetDesign. This is a Danish networking company, and they were a gold certified partner of Cisco, which meant that they were like setting up clients with Cisco's products, and they had a good relationship with Cisco. They understood how those products work, and they used that to market themselves, obviously, as well. And NetDesign had a program called Own Medicine. It's sort of like a program that encouraged penetration testing. It was like the idea is that the employees would be testing all the products that NetDesign was using and installing for its clients to identify vulnerabilities and then fix them. I think this is in September of 2008. One of James's coworkers finds a vulnerability that James reports to Cisco. Cisco issues a patch, and then they give notice of the problem in their next update. So this is a huge success, looks great for his coworker. And James is like, I'm gonna do this. He's challenging himself. I'm going to find a security flaw that's just as good and get them to fix it. And that'll be good for me and that'll be good for NetDesign. He's like doing what he thinks he's supposed to do. So he decides to start experimenting with Cisco's video surveillance manager, which I'm going to call VSM. And it's this software that Cisco sells to its clients to connect and manage video surveillance cameras through a centralized server that can be accessed remotely. So if you can imagine, you can have multiple buildings and multiple locations, and you have video streams coming from all those different places. And you want to have that all consolidated in one place, right? You want to be able to access the video streams and the data And you can have it in one or more primary locations so that you can just keep track of everything. And so this is a software that was purchased by police departments, by airports, by school districts. This is the kind of client who is using this software for their physical security needs, right? So James, he's like, I'm going to test this software. And then it was just way too easy. And these are the allegations we make in our complaint, serious cybersecurity vulnerabilities. And then there were three major consequences of those vulnerabilities. One, he found that the vulnerabilities allowed a user, no matter like what their level of restriction, to gain access to the full system, which means like they could gain access to the computer system. And if the, because these are, this is a system that involves like physical security cameras, if that's connected to the physical security system, then theoretically you could get access to the physical security system too. And then, so second, they also found that users could observe all the videos on the central server and they could modify and disable video feeds. If you're imagining this heist, you know, this is when people who are trying to steal the jewel, like cut off all the video, right? So nobody can see that they're getting in. And then third, and this is maybe the most troubling, it could let an unauthorized user get admin access and then there would be no record that they had gotten that access. Obviously, they could make key changes to the system, but also they could obtain all the passwords of all authorized users. So these are like the serious issues that we were alleging in our complaint. And as you can imagine, it's a really big problem, especially because when you think about what this software was used for, right? This is like to help the physical security systems of police departments, of schools, of airports. And so what we allege is when you have cybersecurity vulnerabilities that could allow things like this to happen, you're totally undermining the reason why anybody would buy this software in the first place. So back to James, he is testing this software, confirming that what he's finding is legit over several weeks, and then he presents them to his supervisor in October of 2008. And at the same time, he submits a report to Cisco. They have a system called PCIRT, Product Security Incident Response Team, so he submits a report there. And over the next several months, he keeps following up with his supervisor. There's a meeting where Cisco representatives come, then he explains what his concerns are. He doesn't really hear about any updates, what's going on, he doesn't know. And then in March of 2009, he's fired. Now he's left Cisco and he's had to sign an NDA actually. And so he's really afraid. He doesn't want to tell people about his concerns because he doesn't want to violate his NDA. But he's still worried and he's still thinking about this. And eventually he confides to his sister and she's like, oh, you have to do something about this. This is like really, really bad. And she begs him, let me report this anonymously. And he says, fine, but you have to do it anonymously. Don't tell anybody that it was for me. Now we're in September 2010. She reaches out anonymously to the FBI in LA. She reaches out to them in LA because she knows and they know that the Los Angeles airport is using this software. You know, you have to remember this is September 2010. So just 9 years before that was September 11th. So this is the concerns that are fueling them to say, hey, we have to talk. Somebody has to know about this. Somebody has to look at this and make sure it's okay. So she reports this. Then, you know, a few months go by. All of a sudden, James gets a call out of the blue from a Los Angeles police officer who's part of the FBI Joint Terrorism Task Force. And he's, of course, like, excuse me, thought I was anonymous. How did this happen? Anyway, he starts sharing information with the FBI. He's just trying to be helpful. And then he starts to think, you know, I really want to have a lawyer. I'm not sure how to navigate this. Yeah. And he says to his sister, you got me into this mess. You have to find me a lawyer. So she found Tim McCormick, who was then at a law firm called Phillips & Cohen. Tim decided to represent him. And in May 2011, they filed the lawsuit in federal court in the Western District of New York under seal. And that sort of set off this multi-state and federal investigation into the allegations in our complaint. Fly, wow. Right?
Hey, everyone. Jacob here. Let me tell you about today's sponsor, Vanta. As the number and severity of third-party breaches continues to rise, companies are increasingly vigilant, not just about how they handle their own data, but how their vendors do as well. For compliance leaders, this means more security reviews are coming across your desk every day, and valuable time is being wasted on manual security reviews. With Vanta questionnaire automation, compliance teams can complete security reviews up to 5 times faster, giving you time back to focus on running your compliance program. Over 8,000 global companies like ZoomInfo, Smart Recruiters, and Noibu use Vanta to save time on security reviews. Register for their upcoming webinar, Vanta in Action, questionnaire automation at vanta.com/GRC Academy. That's vanta.com/GRC Academy. Thanks and enjoy the rest of the episode. No doubt it was an emotional time. He's so worried and stressed out. I just can't imagine the level of stress there. Well, tell us what happened after that.
So from May 2011 until 2019, our complaint stayed under seal and the state and federal government investigated the allegations in our complaint. And then we settled our case in 2019 for roughly $8 million. And it was the first ever False Claims Act settlement based on cybersecurity violations.
Wow. Historical then.
As I said, this is huge in the sense of like there's a lot of different government entities involved. What that means is this is 2010, we're talking about cybersecurity vulnerabilities. There is no cyber fraud initiative yet. One of the tasks that James had and we as his attorneys had is like, how are we going to educate all these enforcement attorneys from all these different government entities on these cybersecurity vulnerability allegations and get them on the same page and agree to do something here, or at least assess whether something should be done? It really could have all fallen apart, I think, so many times over, and it didn't. Thankfully.
Well, that's a lot of pieces and parts there. So how did it not fall apart?
I think there were a few things that really helped us get to a successful resolution of the case. And the first is just James. I wish he was here because you would see he's like the chillest. He is the chillest vibe. He is not a sensational person. Everything he says is so even keel. And I think, I don't know, it just made him seem credible to me. He didn't seem like a person who was crying wolf. And he made this really great video demonstration of the issues that he was seeing. That kind of helped translate the complicated cybersecurity stuff. And it helped translate to like, what are we alleging the real world consequences of these flaws are. And then the other thing that really worked to our benefit is that we got so lucky. We had really great government attorneys, and particularly one government attorney who just really thought this mattered, was really interested in this, really dug in and wanted to learn what was going on. The person I'm thinking of in particular, his name is Adam Pollack. He was then an assistant attorney general in New York. He just got everyone together. He coordinated all of these different state and federal stakeholders. And I remember we had a meeting and I'm telling you, I was a baby attorney. I was bringing massive binders to this meeting and we were like sharing the video on the screen. And I remember somebody from the Oak Ridge Institute for Science and Education was there, which is part of the Department of Energy. And I had to like Google who they were because I was like, do you work for the government? I don't understand. And it was like so many people in the room, you know, to get on the same page. And he really did that. He really got people interested. And I imagine he must have had to herd a lot of cats. And he did it. And sorry to say that he left the government before we settled our case, but the work he did really put the wheels in motion. And now he's a whistleblower attorney too. So I guess he ended up where he was supposed to be. And then the last thing I will say, which sounds like bragging, and I'm really not trying to toot my own horn, but I was just like on a really great team. I was really lucky. It's probably clear from the story, like I didn't file this case. That case came to Tim McCormick, but I really was so lucky to early in my career get to work with like such creative lawyers who like saw this and knew it was an issue. So just real quick, I just wanted to shout out like the amazing people I worked with. In addition to Tim, I got to work with Claire Sylvia at Phillips & Cohen, Molly Nobler at DiCello Levitt, Ann Hartman at Morgan Verkamp, and my partner who I love, Mike Roniker. I got to work on this groundbreaking case so early in my career with these like awesome, smart people. So I just do not take that for granted.
Oh, that's wonderful. Well, fascinating, fascinating story. And I totally hear you on working with amazing people like that. I remember when I was young in my career and just trying to absorb from people who were so much more senior, and it's so beneficial. So that's a wonderful story. Is that common for things to be under seal? Maybe not for 8 years, but what's the norm here?
James starts challenging himself to find this problem, right, in October 2008. And that's when he starts identifying the cybersecurity vulnerabilities that we allege in our complaint. This is October 2008. He's fired in March 2009. Then his sister reports anonymously in September 2010. And then he starts cooperating with the FBI, reaches out, finally gets in contact with Tim McCormick. And then they filed their complaint in May 2011. And then we settled our case in 2019 for roughly $8 million. And this is something that goes to the heart of representing whistleblowers. It's a really long road. It is not uncommon. Yes, that is a long time, and not all False Claims Act cases take that long, but many False Claims Act cases do take that long. And it's not just False Claims Act cases. If you're filing submissions to a whistleblower program, the SEC, CFTC, they can take 5-10 years to get to a resolution. So that's one thing we counsel right off the bat with whistleblowers. Are you ready to sign up for such a long road? Because maybe that's not the right path for everybody. I think it's the perfect path for somebody who could file it, help here and there, and then forget they ever did it. Because if you are waiting for 9 years for the government to get back to you, I think that's devastating for people. I think it's really hard to live like that. And I think the people who can find lives outside of their whistleblowing and find support for their whistleblowing, for the secrecy that is required to be a whistleblower, I mean, I think those are the people who do the best. But it's a really hard road. And I don't recommend it for everybody, frankly. There's a reason why James tried to report anonymously and stay out of it, because there are a lot of benefits to people if you can do that.
Can you talk to us about advice you would give someone who wants to blow the whistle? They have something very serious, very dire. Talk to us about some considerations there.
It kind of depends on your situation, whether you're blowing on the whistle for something that is related to your employment, like you still work there, or whether you're an outsider seeing something and trying to identify that and bring that information to light. I am particularly concerned for my clients that still work at the company and have been trying to kind of escalate issues internally and not able to resolve them. And once they finally get to the point where they want to blow the whistle, that can be really difficult, right? If you still work there, you don't want to be retaliated against. So the first thing I think I would do, well, there's two things. One is document what you're seeing, document what you're doing and what you're witnessing, preserve the evidence that you can preserve, right? This really goes back to the number one advice is like reach out to an attorney. And I don't just mean me, like I think people who are navigating employment, it is really, really helpful to reach out to an employment attorney. If you reach out to my firm, we will recommend employment attorneys to you because it's just very difficult to navigate employment. This is your professional career. Like the retaliation that some people face is really dire. It's not just losing your job. Sometimes you can be blackballed in your industry. And I'm not saying that to scare people or scare you off from being a whistleblower, but you just want to get good advice. And frankly, if you do need to navigate an exit from your company, it's so much better to do that with the assistance of an employment attorney who knows the pitfalls that you could be facing. And also they'll help advise you, hey, you should try to print this out, you know, based on your situation. You shouldn't try to do this and that, the other thing. So we often work very closely with employment attorneys because obviously we want you to have the strongest False Claims Act case or the strongest SEC submission or whatever it is that you can have, but not at the expense of your professional career. We want our clients to stay happy and healthy for a long time. We don't want this to ruin their lives. So that's one piece of advice. And then the other piece of advice, it has to do with sort of how long this whole process can take. I think you have to have the emotional fortitude to be ready for a long haul. These cases can take many, many years, and there's no guarantee. It could take many, many years, and there's no recovery at the end of the day. And some people don't even care. It can take many, many years, and you're not vindicated for what you've seen. It doesn't mean that you're wrong. Sometimes means that the government just wasn't able to make a case, or there isn't a clear legal liability for the wrong that you saw. So I think for whistleblowers who are navigating this and the secrecy required, like the fact that you can't tell your friends, can't tell your coworkers, right, what you're going through. You need to have a really strong support system. With attorneys should be like the least important part of that support system. Like you need to have friends, you need to have family, you need to have people you can rely on, coworkers, and you can't share secrets with them, but they need to support you and we need to know you can rely on that. Because frankly, being a whistleblower is not good for your mental health and you need to have the support system around you. And if you know you don't, you know, then maybe the move for you is to report anonymously. Maybe the move for you is not to file a False Claims Act case. If you are very early in your career and you're at a high risk of being blackballed, maybe it's not the right call to file a case, right? I will say the SEC has really strong anonymity protections. There are some things you can do to preserve your anonymity in a False Claims Act case. You should talk to a lawyer about what you can do there. But it's not the right call for everybody. And for the people that it is the right call for, I think it's not going to be an easy road. And you want to have the team you need to support you through that process.
Excellent advice. Appreciate that. What do you think is coming next in cybersecurity and your realm?
every attorney that I know that works in the space that I'm working in is like trying to understand the cybersecurity requirements that companies are working under and whether they're the issues that they're facing are problematic and like the government should be taking a look at it. And we've talked a lot about False Claims Act cases. That's not obviously the only area that whistleblowers are occupying right now. The SEC has a whistleblower program that accepts tips related to securities laws violations. And one way that you can run afoul of federal securities laws is if you make material misrepresentations to investors about facts that they might consider important in making an investment decision. Obviously, you could imagine how failing to disclose serious cybersecurity issues can open you up then to maybe an SEC enforcement action. And the SEC is, they are active in this space. Just last October, they announced charges against SolarWinds Corporation and its chief information security officer. And they alleged that the software company had such serious internal control failures regarding known cybersecurity risks that they didn't disclose to their investors. And they all sort of came to light after SolarWinds was targeted by this massive cyber attack. I feel like cyber attacks really put you under scrutiny, but everybody is struggling, I think, to figure out when are you supposed to disclose to investors issues that you're seeing in your company. And so I think that navigating that field is going to be something that everybody in the space is going to have to figure out.
Everyone, find Hamza's information in the description if you want to reach out to her. Thank you so much for coming on. Really appreciate your time. It's been great.
Thank you so much, Jacob. This has been a blast. Thank you for having me.
You're so welcome.